Welcome back, everybody, to another deep dive. This time we're diving headfirst into Aristotle's Metaphysics.
Oh, yeah.
Specifically, Book 10.
Okay.
His thoughts on oneness. And I think this is going to be a really fascinating look into how we categorize and understand the world.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things that seems so simple on the surface.
Right.
But then when you actually start to like peel back the layers.
Oh, yeah.
It gets really.
It's really profound.
It's really profound.
Yeah. And it's like he's giving us the blueprint for how we think.
Absolutely. And especially, you know, thousands of years ago.
Right.
To be able to articulate this stuff is just mind blowing.
And right away, right off the bat, he's like, whoa, hold on. One doesn't just mean one thing.
Right.
It actually has several different
categories. Yeah.
Categories.
He gives us four
okay.
primary ways that things can be considered one.
Okay.
So the first one
yeah.
is continuous things.
Right.
So things that are unified and indivisible in their movement.
Like a river.
Exactly like a flowing river.
A beam of light.
A beam of light, yeah.
Yeah.
Anything
uh-huh.
where the movement itself is a single unified action.
Gotcha.
So that makes it one in this sense.
Okay.
Then you've got the second category, which is wholeness.
Okay.
Things that have a defined shape or form.
Okay.
Especially if that form is natural.
Okay.
So like a tree or the human body.
So like a distinct.
Distinct.
Entity.
Entity. Yeah. With clear boundaries.
Okay. What else?
Then you've got individual things.
Okay.
Things that are indivisible in terms of number.
Okay.
So you, the listener, you're one in this sense.
Okay.
Each individual
right.
is a unique and indivisible entity.
Okay.
And finally, he talks about things that are one in terms of their definition or kind.
Okay.
So their concept is indivisible.
Okay.
Like fire is an element.
So it's like these different levels of oneness.
Yes.
Almost different ways that things can be unified.
And what's so interesting
right.
is that he makes a point of saying that being one isn't the same as simply belonging to one of these categories.
I mean,
it's almost as if these meanings are layered on top of each other.
Layered on top of each other.
Yeah. It's not about putting things in a neat boxes.
Yeah.
He's saying that a thing can be one in multiple ways at the same time.
Okay.
So a single tree is one as a continuous whole.
Okay.
It's one as an individual, and it's also one in the sense that it belongs to the species tree.
So it's like it's both unique
yes.
and part of a bigger group.
Exactly.
At the same
time.
Yeah,
and this is where it starts to get really interesting because he makes this connection to the concept of measurement.
This is what blew my mind when I was reading this. I was like, wait a second.
It's a huge.
This is huge.
Yeah.
Because he's basically saying.
Without understanding.
You can't understand quantity unless you understand one.
As a starting point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't have two unless you know what one is.
Exactly.
That's the foundation for all measurement.
Yeah. And then he goes even deeper and he says that the measure has to be homogeneous.
Okay.
With what's being measured.
Homogeneous. What does that even mean?
Right. And, you know, this might seem really obvious.
Okay.
But it's actually really profound.
Okay.
Because he's saying you can't measure length with weight.
Right.
You can't measure a sound with color.
Right.
The measure and the thing being measured have to share a fundamental similarity.
So you measure length with length?
Exactly.
Weight with weight.
Weight with weight and so on.
Okay. But why is that important?
Well, because this idea of homogeneous measure lays the groundwork for standardized units of measurement.
Okay.
Which are essential for any kind of scientific observation.
Oh, wow.
Without it, we wouldn't have the scientific rigor.
I never even thought about that.
That we rely on today.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's just this idea of one.
And then he brings in this analogy
right.
that I love about someone measuring us with a cubit.
The cubit thing.
Yeah.
It's such a
simple way to illustrate a complex idea.
Yeah.
But he's showing us that we often understand ourselves and our qualities.
Right.
In relation to things outside of ourselves.
It's like I need something to compare myself to.
Exactly.
To even know.
You need a reference point.
How big I am.
Yeah.
We understand ourselves.
Through comparison.
Through comparison, yeah.
But hold on, because he doesn't stop there.
Oh, no.
He takes this idea of one beyond just physical quantities.
Okay.
And applies it to qualities and even abstract concepts.
Wait, so one applies to things like color or...
So like color.
Music.
Or music, you got it.
Okay, so...
Think about the color white.
Okay.
It represents a kind of one within the category of color.
Okay.
The specific definite thing.
Right.
Not just a vague idea of unity.
So whether it's a physical object or a color or even...
Like an abstract concept.
An abstract concept. Mm-hmm. There's this fundamental oneness.
There's this fundamental oneness, that defines it.
That defines it.
Yeah, and this is where we start to see
okay.
how this framework of oneness
yeah.
starts to connect to some even bigger ideas.
Like, because there's one.
Of course, there's many.
Many.
And that's precisely where we're headed next.
Where are we going?
Yeah, Aristotle dives into this idea of opposites, this dance between one and money.
Okay.
And how these concepts are fundamentally related.
I'm ready.
Let's go.
It's so easy to get lost in the abstract, you know?
Why?
When you delve into Aristotle.
Right.
But what always strikes me is how grounded he is in the real world.
Oh, totally. You know, he's not like, off in some other dimension.
You know, he's trying to make sense of
what we hear with
the world we experience every day.
Yeah, exactly. And this really comes through when he starts talking about this relationship between one and many.
Right. And he identifies different types of opposition. Yeah. There were so many. I was trying to keep them all straight.
There are so many. And this is where we see his system of categorization really shine.
That's like when he talks about
yeah.
like hot and cold or double and half.
Exactly. So you've got contradictories.
Okay.
Think of those as like total opposites.
Okay.
Like being and non-being.
Got it.
And then you've got privatives.
Privatives.
Where one is the absence of the other.
Okay.
Like sight and blindness.
Okay, I remember those. And then there were...
And then you've got...
Contraries.
Contraries, yeah.
Right, which were like the extremes on a spectrum.
Exactly.
Like hot and cold.
Yeah.
Black and white.
Black and white, yeah.
And then what was the last one?
And then relatives.
Yeah.
Which are defined in relation to each other,
okay.
like double and half.
Okay, so where do one and many fit into all this?
Right.
Because they seem like they're like the ultimate opposites.
Well, he says they're primarily relative opposites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Measure and measurable.
Okay.
They define each other. They exist in relation to each other.
Right. You can't have many without...
You can't have many without the concept of one.
Right, exactly.
To measure that plurality.
Exactly. But then he throws in this whole other concept.
Oh, boy.
Intermediates.
Intermediates.
The things that exist between the contraries.
So not just black and white.
Right.
But all the shades of gray in between.
Exactly. And this is where things get really fascinating.
Okay.
Because he's not just talking about opposites.
Yeah.
He's talking about the whole spectrum of possibilities that exist between them.
So he makes these two?
He makes two key points about these intermediates.
Okay.
First, they belong to the same genus, the same overarching category as the contraries they stand between.
Okay.
So shades of gray are still colors.
Right.
Just like black and white.
Okay, so they share a fundamental nature.
They share that fundamental nature.
With the extremes.
With the extremes. What's the second point?
Yeah, what's the second point? This is where it gets mind-blowing.
Okay.
He says that these intermediates are actually composed of the contraries themselves.
Just a second.
So gray is literally made up of black and white.
Hold on. How is that even possible?
Well, think of it as like a blending or a combination.
Okay.
The intermediate contains aspects of both extremes.
Okay.
Creating a kind of dynamic tension.
Are there any other examples of this?
Yeah. Think of musical notes.
Okay.
The notes between the highest and lowest strings on an instrument
okay.
are intermediates.
Got it.
Composed of the sonic qualities of both extremes.
Okay.
Or imagine a painter mixing colors on a palette.
Starting with black and white, the contraries, and then creating all those shades of gray, the intermediates, by combining them in different proportions.
He's giving us a framework.
Wow.
For understanding how change and development happen.
It's like he's saying.
Not just in the physical world.
Everything.
But in every aspect of our lives.
Exists on a spectrum. With contraries at either end.
Exactly.
And a whole range of possibilities.
And a whole range of possibilities.
And between. But wait, if everything is in this constant state of change,
yeah.
how do we even define what something is?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
And it leads us to another crucial aspect of Aristotle's philosophy.
Okay.
His emphasis on this idea that the world we perceive with our senses is the real world.
Okay.
He's not searching for some other realm of perfect forms.
So truth for Aristotle.
Truth for Aristotle.
He's grounded in what we can
grounded in
see and touch and experience.
What we can see and touch and experience, exactly.
Okay.
And this is key to understanding his concepts of substance, essence, and change.
Okay.
Substance for Aristotle isn't some abstract idea.
Right.
It's the actual concrete things that make up the world.
Yeah.
This table, that chair.
Right.
You and me, we are all substances.
Okay, I can see that.
Right.
And each substance has an essence.
Each substance has an essence. That which makes it the kind of thing it is.
The treeness of a tree.
The treeness of a tree, exactly.
Okay.
But here's where it gets really interesting.
Okay.
For Aristotle, essence isn't static.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
not fixed and unchanging.
What?
It has the capacity to change.
Wait, so you're saying a tree's essence?
A tree's essence can change.
Can change.
Yes. This is where Aristotle's concept of potentiality and actuality comes in.
Okay, I've heard of this.
He says that everything has both a potential to be something and an actuality of what it is.
Got it.
At any given moment.
Okay, so a tree has the potential to grow taller.
Exactly.
To produce fruit.
To produce fruit.
To eventually decay.
Yes. These are all...
But they're all possibilities.
Possibilities within its essence.
Within its essence.
And its actuality.
Okay.
Is its current state of being.
Okay.
Its height, the number of leaves it has.
Right.
Whether it's bearing fruit right now.
So change for Aristotle isn't about something transforming into something completely different. It's about a substance realizing its inherent.
It's about a substance realizing its inherent potential.
Potential.
Yes. It's like a seed becoming a tree.
Right. It's not a sudden switch.
It's not a sudden switch.
It's the gradual unfolding of what was always there.
Exactly.
Waiting to be expressed.
You got it. And this ties back.
Wow.
To his concept of oneness.
Okay.
Because for Aristotle, the unity of a substance, its oneness isn't separate from its potentialities and actualities.
Okay.
They're all part of the same package.
So the oneness of the tree isn't just its current state, but also its capacity for growth, for change, for becoming something more than what it is right now.
That's a brilliant way to put it.
Wow.
It's like he's saying that to truly understand something, we need to see not just what it is now,
yeah,
but also what it has the potential to become.
This is really making me think about how we view ourselves and the world around us.
Yeah.
If change is built into the very fabric of being, then we're all in a constant state of flux.
Yes.
Of becoming.
Of becoming.
And this connects to that famous quote of Aristotle's.
Oh, yeah.
All men by nature desire to know.
He saw this drive for knowledge.
Right.
For understanding as a fundamental part of our essence as human beings.
So this deep dive into Aristotle isn't just about understanding some ancient philosopher's ideas.
Right.
It's about understanding.
It's about understanding what it means to be human.
What it means to be human.
Yeah. To be alive in a world.
To be alive.
That's constant.
In a world that's constantly changing and evolving.
Changing and evolving. That's such a powerful insight.
This is blowing my mind wide open.
I know what you mean.
I feel like I need a moment to process all this.
It's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
But it's so rewarding.
We've covered so much ground already.
I know.
From the different categories of one
yeah.
to the complexities of change and the human desire for knowledge.
Right.
But
we're not done yet.
We're not done yet.
Aristotle takes this even further.
Oh, boy.
Exploring the ethical and political
okay.
dimensions of his philosophy.
All right. So.
And that's where we'll pick up
in
part three.
Where we're going next.
Get ready to explore Aristotle's vision of the good life.
Okay.
And what it means to create a just and flourishing society.
All right, so we're back and we're ready to
dive into
the last part of sure. Aristotle's metaphysics. And
yeah.
we've been talking about the building blocks of reality.
Right.
The nuances of change, the human thirst for knowledge.
The big questions.
But now we're gonna see how these ideas extend
yeah.
beyond metaphysics.
It's remarkable how he connects these seemingly disparate areas. You know, he shows us that his ideas about oneness,
right.
essence, and change have profound implications for how we live our lives and
yeah.
how we organize our societies.
So it's like understanding the nature of reality
yeah.
is essential for understanding.
Is essential for understanding.
Where the good life.
How to live a good life. Exactly.
And this is where his concept of teleology comes into play.
Yes. Which big word.
Was a little intimidated by it first.
Yeah.
But basically.
Like a simple idea.
He believed that everything in the universe has a purpose.
Right.
A final end or goal towards which it strives.
An ultimate aim.
Yeah.
This ultimate aim. And he called it telos.
Telos.
So it's not just that things change.
Right.
But they change.
And change in a purposeful way.
In a purposeful way.
Yeah. Directed towards some ultimate goal.
Which is a pretty radical idea.
It is a pretty radical idea.
Yeah, when you think about it.
Like everything.
And for human beings, he argued that our telos is eudaimonia.
Eudaimonia.
Often translated as happiness or flourishing.
Okay.
But it's not the kind of happiness we might think of today.
So not just like feeling good.
No, not just feeling good, having fun.
Okay.
Aristotle believed that eudaimonia
right.
is a state of living in accordance with reason and virtue.
Okay.
It's about using our rational faculties
okay.
to develop good habits and live a life of excellence. So living a good life is about cultivating virtue.
Yes.
And living in a way that fulfills...
That fulfills our potential?
Our potential as rational beings.
Precisely.
Okay, and he saw virtue.
He saw virtue as a kind of golden mean between extremes.
The golden mean? Okay. Yeah.
So, for example, courage.
Okay.
Is the mean between recklessness and cowardice.
Okay.
Generosity is the mean between extravagance and stinginess.
It's like finding that balance point.
Finding that balance point.
That sweet spot.
That sweet spot.
In our character.
In our character and actions.
And actions. But how do we know what that golden mean is?
Well, that's where practical wisdom comes in.
Practical wisdom. Okay.
Aristotle believed that developing virtue,
right,
is a lifelong process of learning and practice.
Okay.
And that it requires careful observation,
okay,
reflection, mm-hmm, and guidance from those who are wiser than ourselves.
So we need to be constantly learning and growing.
Constantly learning and growing.
Both intellectually.
Both intellectually.
And morally.
And morally, absolutely.
But we can achieve.
And he also emphasized that we can't achieve eudaimonia in isolation.
Right.
He saw human beings as inherently social creatures.
Okay.
Who can only truly flourish within a community.
So the good life isn't just about...
It's not just about individual achievement.
Individual achievement.
It's about being part of something larger,
okay,
than ourselves.
And this is where his political philosophy comes into play.
Exactly.
He argued that the purpose of the state...
The purpose of the state is to create the conditions,
okay,
that allow citizens to flourish.
So the ideal state is one that promotes...
Promotes the well-being.
The well-being of all its citizens.
Of all of its citizens, helping them to achieve eudaimonia.
That's a pretty ambitious goal.
It is a pretty ambitious goal.
And he believed that this could best be achieved.
He believed that this could best be achieved.
Through a system of constitutional government.
Yes, where power is shared and balanced between different branches.
So he didn't like...
He was critical of both tyranny and pure democracy.
Okay.
Believing that they lead to instability and injustice.
So he's advocating for a system of government that's designed to promote both individual flourishing and social harmony.
Exactly. His vision of the ideal state has inspired countless thinkers and political leaders,
right,
throughout history.
Of course.
Of course, his ideas are complex and open to interpretation.
Right. And he was writing in a very different...
And it's important to remember, right, that he was writing in a very different time and context than our own.
Right. So we can't just...
So we can't just take his ideas...
Take his ideas.
And apply them directly to our own society.
And apply them directly to our own society.
But we can still learn from them.
We can still learn from them.
Absolutely.
So as we're wrapping up this deep dive,
yeah,
I'm really struck by the enduring power of Aristotle's thought.
Me too.
You know, he was grappling with some of the most fundamental questions.
Yeah, the biggest questions.
About existence and knowledge and...
About what it means to be human.
The human condition and his answers continue to resonate with us today.
His work reminds us that true knowledge isn't just about accumulating facts.
Right.
It's about engaging with big ideas.
Right.
Challenging our assumptions.
Yeah.
Expanding our understanding of ourselves and the world.
It's about asking those big why questions.
The big why question.
And being willing to wrestle.
And being willing to wrestle.
Get those complex answers.
With those complex answers, yeah. And perhaps the most valuable takeaway,
yeah,
from this deep dive.
From this deep dive.
Is a renewed sense of curiosity, a desire to keep exploring these questions and pushing the boundaries of our understanding.
Absolutely. And on that note, we'll leave you with one final thought to ponder.
Okay. Hit us with it.
If, as Aristotle argued, happiness is about living virtuously, how do we define virtue in our own time and context?
Oh, that's a good one.
What are the golden means,
yeah,
that can guide us toward a life of meaning and purpose?
In the 21st century.
In the 21st century.
That's a question worth exploring.
Yeah. And I have a feeling that Aristotle, with his insatiable curiosity and love of wisdom, would be right there with us.
Oh, he'd be leading the charge.
Eager to join the conversation.
Absolutely.
So keep seeking, keep questioning, keep striving for that good life. Until next time, fellow deep divers.
Keep on diving.